This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. To volunteer, visit LibriVox.org. Don Quixote, Volume 1, by Miguel de Cervantes Saavedra. Translated by John Ormsby. Part 6, Chapters 6 to 8. Chapter 6, of the diverting and important scrutiny which the curate and the barber made in the library of our ingenious gentleman. He was still sleeping, so the curate asked the niece for the keys of the rooms where the books, the authors of all the mischief, were, and right willingly she gave them. They all went in, the housekeeper with them, and found more than 100 volumes of big books very well bound, and some other small ones. The moment the housekeeper saw them, she turned about and ran out of the room, and came back immediately with a saucer of holy water, and a sprinkler, saying, "Here, your worship, Señor Licenciate, sprinkle this room. Don't leave any magician of the many there are in these books to bewitch us, in revenge for our design of banishing them from the world." The simplicity of the housekeeper made the licentiate laugh, and he directed the barber to give him the books one by one, to see what they were about, as there might be some to be found among them that did not deserve the penalty of fire. "No," said the niece, "there is no reason for showing mercy to any of them. They have every one of them done mischief. Better fling them out of the window into the court, and make a pile of them, and set fire to them. Or else carry them into the yard, and there a bonfire can be made without the smoke giving any annoyance." The housekeeper said the same, so eager were they both for the slaughter of those innocents. But the curate would not agree to it without first reading, at any rate, the titles. The first that Master Nicholas put into his hand was The Four Books of Amadis of Gaul. "This seems a mysterious thing," says the curate, "for, as I have heard say, this was the first book of chivalry printed in Spain, and from this all the others derive their birth and origin. So it seems to me that we ought inexorably to condemn it to the flames as the founder of so vile a sect." "Nay, sir," said the barber, "I too have heard say that this is the best of all the books of this kind that have been written, and so as something singular in its line, it ought to be pardoned." "True," said the curate, "and for that reason let its life be spared for the present. Let us see that other which is next to it." "It is," said the barber, "the Sergas de Esplandian, the lawful son of Amadis of Gaul." "Then verily," said the curate, "the merit of the father must not be put down to the account of the son. Take it, mistress housekeeper, open the window and fling it into the yard, and lay the foundation of the pile of the bonfire we are to make." The housekeeper obeyed with great satisfaction, and the worthy Esplandian went flying into the yard to await with all patience the fire that was in store for him. "Proceed," said the curate. "This that comes next," said the barber, "is Amadis of Greece. And indeed, I believe all those on this side are of the same Amadis lineage." "Then to the yard with the whole of them," said the curate, "for to have the burning of Queen Pintiquiniestra and the shepherd Darniel, and his eclogues too, and the bedeviled and involved discourses of his author, I would burn with them the father who begot me, if he were going about in the guise of a knight errant." "I am of the same mind," said the barber. "And so am I," added the niece. "In that case," said the housekeeper, "here, into the yard with them." They were handed to her, and as there were many of them, she spared herself the staircase and flung them out of the window. "Who is that tub there?" said the curate. "This," said the barber, "is Don Olivante de Laura." "The author of that book," said the curate, "was the same that wrote The Garden of Flowers, and truly there is no deciding which of the two books is the more truthful, or, to put it better, the less lying. All I can say is, send this one into the yard for a swaggering fool." "This that follows is Flores Marte of Ircaña," said the barber. "Señor Flores Marte here," said the curate. "Then, by my faith, he must take up his quarters in the yard, in spite of his marvelous birth and visionary adventures, for the stiffness and dryness of his style deserve nothing else. Into the yard with him and the other, mistress housekeeper." "With all my heart, señor," said she, and executed the order with great delight. "This," said the barber, "is the Knight Plateer." "An old book, that," said the curate, "but I find no reason for clemency in it. Send it after the others without appeal," which was done. Another book was opened, and they saw it was entitled The Knight of the Cross. "For the sake of the holy name this book has," said the curate, "its ignorance might be excused. But then, they say, behind the cross there's the devil. To the fire with it." Taking down another book, the barber said, "This is the Mirror of Chivalry." "I know, his worship," said the curate. "That is where Señor Reynaldos of Montalban figures with his friends and comrades, greater thieves than Cacus and the 12 peers of France, with the voracious historian Turpin. However, I am not for condemning them to more than perpetual banishment, because, at any rate, they have some share in the invention of the famous Matteo Boiardo, whence, too, the Christian poet Ludovico Ariosto wove his web, to whom, if I find him here, and speaking any language but his own, I shall show no respect whatever. But if he speaks his own tongue, I will put him upon my head." "Well, I have him in Italian," said the barber, "but I do not understand him." "Nor would it be well that you should understand him," said the curate. "And on that score, we might have excused the captain, if he had not brought him into Spain and turned him into Castilian. He robbed him of a great deal of his natural force, and so do all those who try to turn books written in verse into another language. For with all the pains they take, and all the cleverness they show, they never can reach the level of the originals as they were first produced. In short, I say that this book, and all that may be found treating of those French affairs, should be thrown into or deposited in some dry well until, after more consideration, it is settled what is to be done with them. Excepting always one Bernardo del Carpio that is going about, and another called Roncesvalles. For these, if they come into my hands, shall pass at once into those of the housekeeper, and from hers into the fire without any reprieve." To all this, the barber gave assent, and looked upon it as right and proper, being persuaded that the curate was so staunch to the faith and loyal to the truth, that he would not for the world say anything opposed to them. Opening another book, he saw it was Pomerin de Oliva, and beside it was another one called Pomerin of England. Seeing which, the licentiate said, "Let the olive be made firewood of at once, and burned until no ashes even are left, and let that palm of England be kept and preserved as a thing that stands alone, and let such another case be made for it as that which Alexander found among the spoils of Darius, and set aside for the safekeeping of the works of the poet Homer. This book, gossip, is of authority for two reasons. First, because it is very good, and second, because it is said to have been written by a wise and witty king of Portugal. All the adventures of the castle of Miraguarda are excellent and of admirable contrivance, and the language is polished and clear. Studying and observing the style befitting the speaker with propriety and judgment. So then, provided it seems good to you, Master Nicholas, I say, let this and Amadis of Gaul be remitted without the penalty of fire. And as for all the rest, let them perish without further question or query. Nay, gossip, said the barber, for this that I have here is the famous Don Belianis. Well, said the curate, that and the second, third, and fourth parts of all stand in need of a little rhubarb to purge their excess of bile, and they must be cleared of all that stuff about the Castle of Fame and other greater affectations, to which end let them be allowed the overseas term, and according as they mend, so shall mercy or justice be meted out to them, and in the meantime, gossip, do you keep them in your house, and let no one read them. With all my heart, said the barber, and not caring to tire himself with reading more books of chivalry, he told the housekeeper to take all the big ones and throw them into the yard. It was not said to one dull or deaf, but to one who enjoyed burning them more than weaving the broadest and finest web that could be. And seizing about eight at a time, she flung them out of the window. In carrying so many together, she let one fall at the feet of the barber, who took it up, curious to know what it was, and found it said, History of the Famous Knight Tirante el Blanco. God bless me, said the curate, Tirante el Blanco here? Hand it over, gossip, for in it I reckon I have found a treasury of enjoyment and a mine of recreation. Here is Don Qui Rialesen of Montalvan, a valiant knight, and his brother Thomas of Montalvan, and the knight Fonseca, with the battle the bold Tirante fought with the mastiff, and the witticism of the damsel Placer de mi vida, and the loves and wiles of the widow Reposada, and the empress in love with the squire Hippolito. In truth, gossip, by right of its style, it is the best book in the world. Here, knights eat and sleep, and die in their beds, and make their wills before dying, and a great deal of more of which there are not in the other books. Nevertheless, I say, he who wrote it, for deliberately composing such fooleries, deserves to be sent to the galleys for life. Take it home with you and read it, and you will see that what I have said is true. As you will, said the barber, but what are we to do with these little books that are left? They must be not chivalry, but poetry, said the curate. And opening up one, he saw it was the Diana of Jorge de Montemayor. And supposing all the others to be of the same sort, he said, These do not deserve to be burned like the others, for they neither do nor can do the mischief the books of chivalry have done, being books of entertainment that can hurt no one. Ah, senor, said the niece, your worship had better order these to be burned as well as the others, for it would be no wonder if, after being cured of his chivalry disorder, my uncle, by reading these, took a fancy to turn shepherd and range the woods and fields singing and piping, or what would be still worse, to turn poet, which they say is an incurable and infectious malady. The damsel is right, said the curate, and it will be well to put this stumbling block and temptation out of our friend's way. To begin, then, with the Diana of Montemayor, I am of the opinion it should not be burned, but that it should be cleared of all that about the sage Felicia and the magic water, and of almost all the longer pieces of verse. Let it keep and welcome its prose and the honor of being the first of books of the kind. This that comes next, said the barber, is the Diana entitled The Second Part by the Salamancan, and this other has the same title, and its author is Gil Polo. As for the Salamancan, replied the curate, let it go to swell the number of the condemned in the yard, and let Gil Polo's be preserved as if it came from Apollo himself. But get on, gossip, and make haste, for it is growing late. This book, said the barber, opening another, is the 10 books of the Fortune of Love, written by Antonio de Lofraso, a Sardinian poet. By the orders I have received, said the curate, since Apollo has been Apollo, and the muses have been muses, and poets have been poets, so droll and absurd a book as this has never been written, and in its way it is the best and the most singular of all of this species that have as yet appeared, and he who has not read it may be sure that he has never read what is delightful. Give it here, gossip, for I make more account of having found it than if they had given me a cassock of Florence stuff. He put it aside with extreme satisfaction, and the barber went on. These that come next are the Shepherd of Iberia, Nymphs of Henares, and the Enlightenment of Jealousy. Then all we have to do, said the curate, is to hand them over to the secular arm of the housekeeper, and ask me not why, or we shall never have done. The next is the Pastor of Phillida. No pastor that, said the curate, but a highly polished courtier. Let it be preserved as a precious jewel. This large one here, said the barber, is called the Treasury of Poems. If there were not so many of them, said the curate, they would be more relished. This book must be weeded and cleansed of certain vulgarities, which it has with its excellences. Let it be preserved, because the author is a friend of mine, and out of respect for other more heroic and loftier works that he has written. This, continued the barber, is the Cancionero of Lopez de Maldonado. The author of that book, too, said the curate, is a great friend of mine, and his verses from his own mouth are the admiration of all who hear them, for such is the sweetness of his voice that he enchants when he chants them. It gives rather too much of its eclogues, but what is good was never yet plentiful. Let it be kept with those that have been set apart. But what book is next with it? The Galatea of Miguel de Cervantes, said the barber. That Cervantes has been for many years a great friend of mine, and to my knowledge he has had more experience in reverses than in verses. His book has some good invention in it. Presents us with something, but brings nothing to a conclusion. We must wait for the second part, it promises. Perhaps with amendment it may succeed in winning the full measure of grace that is now denied it. And in the meantime, do you, Senor Gossip, keep it shut in your own quarters. Very good, said the barber. And here come another three, together. The Araucana of Don Alonso de Ercilla, the Austriada of Juan Rufo, Justice of Cordova, and the Montserrat of Cristobal de Virues, the Valencian poet. These three books, said the curate, are the best that have been written in Castilian in heroic verse, and they may compare with the most famous of Italy. Let them be preserved as the richest treasures of poetry that Spain possesses. The curate was tired and would not look into any more books, and so he decided that contents uncertified, all the rest should be burned. But just then the barber held open one called The Tears of Angelica. "Oh, I should have shed tears myself," said the curate when he heard the title, "had I ordered that book to be burned, for its author was one of the famous poets of the world, not to say of Spain, and was very happy in the translation of some of Ovid's fables." Chapter 7 of the Second Sally of our worthy knight Don Quixote of La Mancha. At this instant Don Quixote began shouting out, "Hear, hear, valiant knights! Here is need for you to put forth the might of your strong arms, for they of the court are gaining the mastery in the tourney." Called away by this noise and outcry, they proceeded no farther with the scrutiny of the remaining books, and so it is thought that the Carolea, the Lion of Spain, and the Deeds of the Emperor, written by Don Luis de Avila, went to the fire unseen and unheard, for, no doubt, they were among those that remained, and perhaps if the curate had seen them, they would not have undergone so severe a sentence. When they reached Don Quixote, he was already out of bed, and was still shouting and raving and slashing and cutting all around, as wide awake as if he had never slept. They closed with him, and by force got him back into the bed. And when he had become a little calm, addressing the curate, he said to him, "Of a truth, Señor Archbishop Turpin, it is a great disgrace for us, who call ourselves the 12 peers, so carelessly to allow the knights of the court to gain the victory in this tourney. We, the adventurers, having carried off the honor on the 3 former days." "Hush, gossip," said the curate. "Please God, the luck may turn, and what is lost today may be won tomorrow. For the present, let your worship have a care to your health, for it seems to me that you are over-fatigued, if not badly wounded." "Wounded? No," said Don Quixote, "but bruised and battered, no doubt, for that bastard Don Roland has cudgeled me with the trunk of an oak tree, and all for envy, because he sees that I alone rival him in his achievements. But I should not call myself Reinaldos of Montalban did he not pay me for it, in spite of all his enchantments, as soon as I rise from this bed. For the present, let them bring me something to eat, for that, I feel, is what will be more to my purpose, and leave it to me to avenge myself." They did as he wished. They gave him something to eat, and once more he fell asleep, leaving them marveling at his madness. That night the housekeeper burned to ashes all the books that were in the yard and in the whole house, and some must have been consumed that deserved preservation in everlasting archives, but their fate and the laziness of the examiner did not permit it, and so in them was verified the proverb that the innocent suffer for the guilty. One of the remedies which the curate and the barber immediately applied to their friend's disorder was to wall up and plaster the room where the books were, so that when he got up he should not find them, possibly the cause being removed, the effect might cease, and they might say that a magician had carried them off, room and all. And this was done with all dispatch. 2 days later, Don Quixote got up, and the first thing he did was to go and look for his books, and not finding the room where he had left it, he wandered from side to side looking for it. He came to the place where the door used to be, and tried it with his hands, and turned and twisted his eyes in every direction without saying a word. But after a good while, he asked his housekeeper whereabouts was the room that held his books. The housekeeper, who had been already well instructed in what she was to answer, said, "What room or what nothing is it that your worship is looking for? There are neither room nor books in this house now, for the devil has carried all away." "It was not the devil," said the niece, "but a magician who came on a cloud one night after the day your worship left us, and dismounting from a serpent that he rode, he entered the room, and what he did there I know not, but after a little while he made off, flying through the roof, and left the house full of smoke, and when we went to see what he had done, we saw neither book nor room. But we remember very well, the housekeeper and I, that on leaving, the old villain said in a loud voice that, for a private grudge he owed the owner of the books in the room, he had done mischief in that house that would be discovered by and by. He said, too, that his name was the Sage Muneton. He must have said Friston, said Don Quixote. I don't know whether he called himself Friston or Friton, said the housekeeper. I only know that his name ended with Don. So it does, said Don Quixote, and he is a sage magician, a great enemy of mine, who has a spite against me, because he knows by his arts and lore that in process of time I am to engage in single combat with a knight whom he befriends, and that I am to conquer, and he will be unable to prevent it, and for this reason he endeavors to do me all the ill turns that he can. But I promise him it will be hard for him to oppose or avoid what is decreed by heaven.
Who doubts that? Said the niece. But, uncle, who mixes you up in these quarrels? Would it not be better to remain at peace in your own house, instead of roaming the world looking for better bread than ever came of wheat, never reflecting that many go for wool and come back shorn?
Oh, niece of mine, replied Don Quixote, how much astray art thou in thy reckoning. Ere they shear me, I shall have plucked away and stripped off the beards of all who dare to touch only the tip of a hair of mine. The two were unwilling to make any further answer, as they saw that his anger was kindling. In short, then, he remained at home 15 days, very quietly, without showing any signs of a desire to take up with his former delusions, and during this time he held lively discussions with his two gossips, the curate and the barber, on the point he maintained, that knights errant were what the world stood most in need of, and that in him was to be accomplished the revival of knight errantry. The curate sometimes contradicted him, sometimes agreed with him, for if he had not observed this precaution, he would have been unable to bring him to reason. Meanwhile, Don Quixote worked upon a farm laborer, a neighbor of his, an honest man, if indeed that title can be given to him who is poor, but with very little wit in his pate. In a word, he so talked him over, and with such persuasions and promises, that the poor clown made up his mind to sally forth with him and serve him as esquire. Don Quixote, among other things, told him he ought to be ready to go with him gladly, because any moment an adventure might occur that might win an island in the twinkling of an eye and leave him governor of it. On these and like promises, Sancho Panza, for so the laborer was called, left wife and children, and engaged himself as esquire to his neighbor. Don Quixote next set about getting some money, and selling one thing and pawning another, and making a bad bargain in every case, he got together a fair sum. He provided himself with a buckler, which he begged as a loan from a friend, and, restoring his battered helmet as best he could, he warned his squire Sancho of the day and hour he meant to set out, that he might provide himself with what he thought most needful. Above all, he charged him to take alforjas with him. The other said he would, and that he meant to take also a very good ass he had, as he was not much given to going on foot. About the ass, Don Quixote hesitated a little, trying whether he could call to mind any knight-errant taking with him an esquire mounted on assback, but no instance occurred to his memory. For all that, however, he determined to take him, intending to furnish him with a more honorable mount when a chance of it presented itself, by appropriating the horse of the first discourteous knight he encountered.
Himself he provided with shirts and such other things as he could, according to the advice the host had given him. All which being done, without taking leave, Sancho Panza of his wife and children, or Don Quixote of his housekeeper and niece, they sallied forth, unseen by anybody, from the village one night, and made such good way in the course of it, that by daylight they held themselves safe from discovery, even should search be made for them. Sancho rode on his ass like a patriarch, with his alforjas and bota, and longing to see himself soon governor of the island his master had promised him. Don Quixote decided upon taking the same route and road he had taken on his first journey, that over the Campo de Montiel, which he traveled with less discomfort than on the last occasion, for, as it was early morning and the rays of the sun fell on them obliquely, the heat did not distress them. "And now," said Sancho Panza to his master, "your worship will take care, Señor Knight-errant, not to forget about the island you promised me, for be it ever so big, I'll be equal to governing it." To which Don Quixote replied, "Thou must know, friend Sancho Panza, that it was a practice very much in vogue with the knights-errant of old to make their squires governors of the islands or kingdoms they won, and I am determined that there shall be no failure on my part in so liberal a custom. On the contrary, I mean to improve upon it, for they sometimes, and perhaps most frequently, waited until their squires were old, and then, when they had enough of their service and hard days and worse nights, they gave them some title or other of count, or at the most, marquis, of some valley or province, more or less. But if thou livest, and I live, it may well be that before 6 days are over, I may have won some kingdom that has others dependent upon it, which will be just the thing to enable thee to be crowned king of one of them. Nor needst thou count this wonderful, for things and chances fall to the lot of such knights in ways so unexampled and unexpected that I might easily give thee even more than I promised thee." "In that case," said Sancho Panza, "if I should become a king by one of those miracles your worship speaks of, even Juana Gutierrez, my old woman, would come to be queen, and my children infantes." "Well, who doubts it?" said Don Quixote. "Oh, I doubt it," replied Sancho Panza, "because for my part I am persuaded that though God should shower down kingdoms upon earth, not one of them would fit the head of Mari Gutierrez. Let me tell you, señor, she is not worth 2 maravedis for a queen. Countess will fit her better, and that only with God's help." "Leave it to God, Sancho," returned Don Quixote, "for he will give her what suits her best. But do not undervalue thyself so much as to come to be content with anything less than being governor of a province." "I will not, señor," answered Sancho, "especially as I have a man of such quality for a master in your worship, who will know how to give me all that will be suitable for me, and that I can bear." Chapter 8 Of the good fortune which the valiant Don Quixote had in the terrible and undreamt of adventure of the windmills, with other occurrences worthy to be fitly recorded. At this point they came in sight of 30 or 40 windmills that there are on plain, and as soon as Don Quixote saw them, he said to his squire, "Fortune is arranging matters for us better than we could have shaped our desires ourselves. For look here, friend Sancho Panza, where 30 or more monstrous giants present themselves, all of which I mean to engage in battle and slay, and with whose spoils we shall begin to make our fortunes. For this is the righteous warfare, and it is God's service to sweep so evil a breed from the face of the earth." "What giants?" said Sancho Panza. those thou seest there," answered his master, "with the long arms, and some have them nearly 2 leagues long." "Look, your worship," said Sancho, "what we see there are not giants, but windmills, and what seem to be their arms are the sails that, turned by the wind, make the millstones go." "It is easy to see," replied Don Quixote, "that thou art not used to this business of adventure. Those are giants, and if thou art afraid, away with thee, out of this, and betake thyself to prayer, while I engage them in fierce and unequal combat." So saying, he gave the spur to his steed Rocinante. Heedless of the cries of his squire, Sancho sent after him, warning him that most certainly they were windmills and not giants he was going to attack. He, however, was so positive that they were giants that he neither heard the cries of Sancho nor perceived, near as he was, what they were, but made at them shouting, "Fly not, cowards and vile beings, for a single knight attacks you." A slight breeze at this moment sprang up, and the great sails began to move, seeing which Don Quixote exclaimed, "Though ye flourish more arms than the giant Briareus, ye have to reckon with me." So saying, and committing himself with all his heart to his lady Dulcinea, imploring her to support him in such a peril, with lance in rest, and covered by his buckler, he charged at Rocinante's fullest gallop, and fell upon the first mill that stood in front of him. But as he drove his lance point into the sail, the wind whirled it round with such force that it shivered the lance to pieces, sweeping with it horse and rider, who went rolling over on the plain in a sorry condition. Sancho hastened to his assistance as fast as his ass could go, and when he came up, found him unable to move, with such a shock had Rocinante fallen with him. "God bless me," said Sancho, "did I not tell your worship to mind what you were about, for they were only windmills, and no one could have made any mistake about it but one who had something of the same kind in his head." "Hush, friend Sancho," replied Don Quixote, "the fortunes of war, more than any other, are liable to frequent fluctuations, and moreover, I think, and it is the truth, that that same sage Friston, who carried off my study and books, has turned these giants into mills in order to rob me of the glory of vanquishing them. Such is the enmity he bears toward me, but in the end his wicked arts will avail but little against my good sword." "God order it as he may," said Sancho Panza, and helping him to rise, got him up again on Rocinante, whose shoulder was half out, and then, discussing the late adventure, they followed the road to Puerto Lapice, for there, said Don Quixote, they could not fail to find adventures in abundance and variety, as it was a great thoroughfare. For all that, he was much grieved at the loss of his lance, and saying so to his squire, he added, "I remember having read how a Spanish knight, Diego Perez de Vargas by name, having broken his sword in battle, tore from an oak a ponderous branch or bough, and with it did such things that day, and pounded so many Moors, that he got the surname of Machuca, and he and his descendants, from that day forth, were called Vargas y Machuca. I mention this because from the first oak I see, I mean to rend such another branch, large and stout like that, with which I am determined and resolved to such deeds that thou mayst deem thyself very fortunate in being found worthy to come and see them, and be an eyewitness of things that will with difficulty be believed." "Be that as it will," said Sancho, "I believe it is all as your worship says it. But straighten yourself a little, for you seem all on one side, maybe from the shaking in the fall." "That is the truth," said Don Quixote, "and if I make no complaint of the pain, it is because knight-errants are not permitted to complain of any wound, even though their bowels be coming out through it. "If so," said Sancho, "I have nothing to say, but God knows I would rather your worship complained when anything ailed you. For my part, I confess I must complain, however small the ache may be, unless this rule about not complaining extends to the squires of knight-errants also." Don Quixote could not help laughing at his squire's simplicity, and he assured him he might complain whenever and however he chose, just as he liked, for so far he had never read of anything to the contrary in the order of knighthood. Sancho bade him remember it was dinner time, to which his master answered that he wanted nothing himself just then, but that he might eat when he had a mind. With this permission, Sancho settled himself as comfortably as he could on his beast, and taking out of the alforjas what he had stowed away in them, he jogged along behind his master, munching deliberately, and from time to time taking a pull at the bota, with a relish that the thirstiest tapster in Malaga might have envied. And while he went on in this way, gulping down draft after draft, he never gave a thought to any of the promises his master had made him, nor did he rate it as hardship, but rather as recreation going in quest of adventures, however dangerous they might be. Finally, they passed the night among some trees, from one of which Don Quixote plucked a dry branch to serve him after a fashion as a lance, and fixed on it the head he had removed from the broken one. All that night Don Quixote lay awake thinking of his lady Dulcinea, in order to conform to what he had read in his books. How many nights in the forest and deserts knights used to lie sleepless, supported by the memory of their mistresses. Not so did Sancho Panza spend it, for having his stomach full of something stronger than chicory water, he made but one sleep of it, and if his master had not called him, neither the rays of the sun beating on his face, nor all the cheery notes of the birds welcoming the approach of day, would have had power to waken him. On getting up, he tried the bota and found it somewhat less full than the night before, which grieved his heart, because they did not seem to be on the way to remedy the deficiency readily. Don Quixote did not care to break his fast, for, as has been already said, he confined himself to savory recollections for nourishment. They returned to the road that they had set out with, leading to Puerto Lapice, and at 3 in the afternoon they came in sight of it. "Here, brother Sancho Panza," said Don Quixote when he saw it, "we may plunge our hands up to the elbows in what they call adventures. But observe, even shouldst thou see me in the greatest danger in the world, thou must not put a hand to thy sword in my defense, unless indeed thou perceivest that those who assail me are rabble or base folk, for in that case thou mayest very properly aid me. But if they be knights, it is on no account permitted or allowed thee by the laws of knighthood to help me until thou hast been dubbed a knight."
"Most certainly, señor," replied Sancho, "your worship shall be fully obeyed in this manner, all the more as of myself I am peaceful and no friend to mixing in strife and quarrels. It is true that, as regards the defense of my own person, I shall not give much heed to those laws, for laws human and divine allow each one to defend himself against any assailant whatever."
"That I grant," said Don Quixote, "but in this matter of aiding me against knights, thou must put a restraint upon thy natural impetuosity."
"I will do so, I promise you," answered Sancho, "and will keep this precept as carefully as Sunday."
While they were thus talking, there appeared on the road two friars of the order of Saint Benedict, mounted on two dromedaries, for not less tall were the two mules they rode on. They wore traveling spectacles and carried sunshades, and behind them came a coach attended by 4 or 5 persons on horseback and 2 muleteers on foot. In the coach there was, as afterwards appeared, a Biscay lady on her way to Seville, where her husband was about to take passage for the Indies with an appointment of high honor. The friars, though going the same road, were not in her company, but the moment Don Quixote perceived them, he said to his squire, "Either I am mistaken, or this is going to be the most famous adventure that has ever been seen, for those black bodies we see there must be, and doubtless are, magicians who are carrying off some stolen princess in that coach, and with all my might I must undo this wrong." "This will be worse than the windmill," said Sancho. "Look, señor, those are friars of St. Benedict, and the coach plainly belongs to some travelers. I tell you, mind well what you are about, and don't let the devil mislead you." "I have told thee already, Sancho," replied Don Quixote, "that on the subject of adventures thou knowest little. What I say is the truth, as thou shalt presently see." So saying, he advanced and posted himself in the middle of the road along which the friars were coming, and as soon as he thought they had come near enough to hear what he said, he cried aloud, "Devilish and unnatural beings, release instantly the high-born princesses whom you are carrying off by force in this coach, else prepare to meet a speedy death as the just punishment of your evil deeds." The friars drew rein and stood wondering at the appearance of Don Quixote, as well as at his words, to which they replied, "Señor Caballero, we are not devilish or unnatural, but two brothers of St. Benedict following our road, nor do we know whether or not there are any captive princesses coming in this coach." "No soft words with me, for I know you, lying rabble," said Don Quixote, and without waiting for a reply, he spurred Rocinante, and with leveled lance charged the first friar with such fury and determination that if the friar had not flung himself off the mule, he would have brought him to the ground against his will, and sore wounded, if not killed him outright. The second brother, seeing how his comrade was treated, drove his heels into his castle of a mule, and made off across the country faster than the wind. Sancho Panza, when he saw the friar on the ground, dismounting briskly from his ass, rushed towards him and began to strip off his gown. At that instant the friar's muleteers came up and asked what he was stripping him for. Sancho answered them that this fell to him lawfully as spoil of the battle which his lord Don Quixote had won. The muleteers, who had no idea of a joke and did not understand all this about battles and spoils, seeing that Don Quixote was some distance off talking to the travelers in the coach, fell upon Sancho, knocked him down, and leaving hardly a hair in his beard, belabored him with kicks, and left him stretched breathless and senseless on the ground, and without any more delay, helped the friar to mount, who, trembling, terrified, and pale, as soon as he found himself in the saddle, spurred after his companion, who was standing at a distance, looking on, watching the result of the onslaught. Then, not caring to wait for the end of the affair just begun, they pursued their journey, making more crosses than if they had the devil after them. Don Quixote was, as has been said, speaking to the lady in the coach. "Your beauty, lady mine," said he, "may now dispose of your person as may be most in accordance with your pleasure, for the pride of your ravishers lies prostrate on the ground through this strong arm of mine, and lest you should be pining to know the name of your deliverer, know that I am called Don Quixote of La Mancha, knight-errant and adventurer, and captive to the peerless and beautiful lady Dulcinea del Toboso. And in return for the service you have received of me, I ask no more than that you should return to El Toboso, and on my behalf present yourself before that lady, and tell her what I have done to set you free." One of the squires in attendance upon the coach, a Biscayan, was listening to all Don Quixote was saying, and perceiving that he would not allow the coach to go on, but was saying it must return at once to El Toboso, he made at him, and seizing his lance, addressed him in bad Castilian and worse Biscayan, after his fashion, "Begone, caballero, and ill go with thee, by the God that made thee, unless thou quittest coach, slayest thee as art here a Biscayan." Don Quixote understood him quite well, and answered him very quietly, "If thou wert a knight, and as thou art none, I should have already chastised thy folly and rashness, miserable creature." To which the Biscayan returned, "I am no gentleman. I swear to God thou liest, as I am a Christian. If thou droppest lance and drawest sword, soon shalt thou see thou art carrying water to the cat. Biscayan on land, Hidalgo at sea, Hidalgo at the devil. And look, if thou sayest otherwise, thou liest." "You will see presently," said Aguares, replied Don Quixote, and throwing his lance on the ground, he drew his sword, braced his buckler on his arm, and attacked the Biscayan, bent upon taking his life. The Biscayan, when he saw him coming on, though he wished to dismount from his mule, in which, being one of those sorry ones let out for hire, he had no confidence, had no choice but to draw his sword. It was lucky for him, however, that he was near the coach, from which he was able to snatch a cushion that served him for a shield, and they went at one another as if they had been two mortal enemies. The others strove to make peace between them, but could not, for the Biscayan declared in his disjointed phrases that if they did not let him finish his battle, he would kill his mistress and everyone that strove to prevent him. The lady in the coach, amazed and terrified at what she saw, ordered the coachman to draw aside a little, and set herself to watch this severe struggle, in the course of which the Biscayan smote Don Quixote a mighty stroke on the shoulder over the top of his buckler, which, given to one without armor, would have cleft him to the waist. Don Quixote, feeling the weight of this prodigious blow, cried aloud, saying, "O lady of my soul, Dulcinea, flower of beauty, come to the aid of this your knight, who, in fulfilling his obligations to your beauty, finds himself in this extreme peril. To say this, to lift his sword, to shelter himself well behind his buckler, and to assail the Biscayan was the work of an instant, determined as he was to venture all upon a single blow." The Biscayan, seeing him come on in this way, was convinced of his courage by his spirited bearing, and resolved to follow his example, so he waited for him, keeping well under cover of his cushion, being unable to execute any sort of maneuver with his mule, which, dead tired, and never meant for this kind of game, could not stir a step. On then, as aforesaid, came Don Quixote, against the wary Biscayan, with uplifted sword and a firm intention of splitting him in half, and while on his side the Biscayan waited for him, sword in hand, and under the protection of his cushion, and all present stood trembling, waiting in the suspense the result of blows such as threatened to fall, and the lady in the coach and the rest of her following were making a thousand vows and offerings to all the images and shrines of Spain, that God might deliver her squire, and all of them, from this great peril in which they found themselves. But it spoils all that at this point and crisis the author of the history leaves this battle impending, giving as excuse that he could find nothing more written about those achievements of Don Quixote than what has been already set forth. It is true the second author of this work was unwilling to believe that a history so curious could have been allowed to fall under the sentence of oblivion, or that the wits of La Mancha could have been so undiscerning as not to preserve in their archives or registries some documents referring to this famous knight. And this being his persuasion, he did not despair of finding the conclusion of this pleasant history, which, Heaven favoring him, he did find in a way that shall be related in the second part. End of part 6. Recorded by Denny Sayers in Modesto, California, Spring 2006.